Thank you, Vicky. And a very special welcome to you today. If you're here because of family or friends who've been baptised, it's great to have you here especially. Let me just talk about why we're here today. We're here to do baptisms, of course, but more fundamentally than that, we're here to celebrate the risen Christ. We're here to celebrate the historic truth of the bodily resurrection of Jesus. And that historic truth of a man rising from the dead is absolutely vital to the Christian faith. Last week, if you were here, we saw this probably earliest creed of the Christian faith, the earliest statement of what it means to be a Christian. Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised again on the third day according to the scriptures. That's what it means to be a Christian. In its very, very simplest terms, is believing the truth of that and applying it, or having it applied to your own heart. Now, last week, I showed you this survey done by the BBC, which showed that 57% of active Christians, that is churchgoers, in their vocabulary, 57% of churchgoers believe the Bible's version of events to be true. 36% of churchgoers, 36% believe that Jesus kind of rose from the dead, but not really as the Bible says it. Kind of maybe he rose metaphorically or something like that. And 5% of people who go to church week by week and identify as Christians believe he's still dead. Now, why they still go to church is anybody's guess. Maybe they enjoy the free coffee or something. I don't know. But there we have it. Now, today I want to show, and we haven't got along this morning. Obviously, you appreciate what we were doing this morning. So we're going to be a bit shorter. But what I want to show you this morning, why belief in the resurrection is reasonable. And if you're a Christian here this morning, my aim, if you're a Christian today, is to bolster your faith. You already believe this, otherwise you wouldn't be a Christian. Okay? Because by definition, you have to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, otherwise you're not a Christian. So if you're a Christian today, I want to bolster your faith. If you're not a Christian here this morning, it's great to have you. And today, I want to give you some things to think about. I really hope this makes you think. And I've got this little book, actually, for anybody who wants one. I've got about 20-odd copies, I think. It's called Your Verdict on the Empty Tomb. And I would love to give one of these to anybody who wants one, whether you're a Christian or not. It's all about the evidence that I'm going to talk about today. So there's a pile of those there, and there's a pile over there as well. Right. Let's get on with it. Right, so there are four indisputable historic facts that nobody really disagrees with, okay? Whether you're an academic, whether you're a skeptic, whether you're an atheist, nobody really disagrees with these four. There's always some on the nutty fringe, all right? But basically, nobody disagrees with these four. First of all, that Jesus was crucified. Nobody disagrees that Jesus was crucified. Nobody these days, unless... But back in the 19th century, it was very fashionable to say that Jesus never existed. No academics believe that anymore, all right? You sometimes get internet memes and stuff that talk about that. But in reality, people who know what they're talking about, everybody believes that Jesus existed because the evidence is overwhelming. The evidence is also overwhelming that he was crucified. Nobody disputes the fact that his body disappeared, okay? How and why, we're going to talk about. But nobody really disputes that his body disappeared. Nobody disputes, really, that for about 40 days, people claim to have seen Jesus. Okay, and we'll talk about reasons why that might have been, but nobody really disputes that. And fourthly, nobody disputes that the lives of his followers were completely transformed by something. Something happened that transformed them from being very fearful, very cowardly, into starting the fastest growing faith that's come to dominate the world. Okay. So, question is, how do we explain an empty tomb? How do we explain an empty tomb? There are some options. This is the first one. Maybe Jesus didn't really die. Maybe he fainted. On the cross, he fainted, but then recovered. It's a cold tomb. They put him in a cold tomb. He resuscitates after a while. Okay. Is that possible? Well, let me give you some reasons why that doesn't really hold water, for me at least. And you can decide whether it holds water for you or not. Roman soldiers were experts at killing people. Okay? That was their job. You know, you might be a plumber, you might be a farmer, you might be a preacher. Their job was killing people, all right? They knew what they were doing, okay? It was routine. Crucifixion, at the time of Jesus, Roman crucifixion was at a peak. You know, they were doing a lot of these things, all right? Jesus was not unique in being crucified. A lot of people were crucified. Before he was crucified, he was flogged. And if you were here Friday night, Matt Green gave us some information about that I'm not going to go over again. But just to say, Jesus was beaten up so badly that he couldn't even carry his own cross. He's a man who spent the first 30 years of his life as a builder. Couldn't carry a piece of 4x2 up the hill because he'd been beaten so badly. He was then crucified. Crucified was not a punishment. It was not a form of torture that you sort of did for a bit and then you got off. Crucifixion was a form of execution. Okay, nobody survived crucifixion. Jesus was speared, and it says in the eyewitness accounts that blood and water came out of the wound. Now, medical people tell me that that's very likely indicative of his heart being pierced, which obviously is not something which you get over. Witnesses said that he died. The centurion standing there by the cross, who'd seen many, many, many deaths, because that was his job to preside over these things, says in Mark chapter 15, when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." The centurion saw him die. But let's... Forget all that for a minute, all right? Let's say he'd survived. Let's say that somehow the Roman soldiers have made a most appalling mistake and he'd survived. Would he really have been strong enough to roll the stone away? It was probably impossible from the inside. If you look at these tombs, you can go and see these tombs still back in Israel. In the gospel accounts, it's an angel who rolls the stone away from the outside. Because from the inside, there's no way of doing it. It's a one-way system. They didn't plan for people to wake up, okay? So there's no like back door or something. Okay, you couldn't get out. Interestingly, there's a group of four women go to the tomb. We didn't read it just now, but there are four women go to the tomb, and between the four of them, they say, "How are we going to get the tomb open? But I hope there's some more people around who we can help to roll the stone away, because between the four of us, we're not going to be able to do it." So could one man who's endured all that do that from the inside? And don't forget, the tomb was guarded. We just read that. Vicky read that to us. Pilate said, because they were worried about this conspiracy. They were worried that the disciples might come along and steal the body, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So Pilate says, "Okay, take a bunch of soldiers and make it as secure as you know how." Now, Romans were pretty good on security, you would imagine. And the technical word they use means at least four Roman soldiers, more likely 16 and possibly more. So, the question is, how could Jesus, even if he got out of the tomb somehow, even if he hadn't died, how could he get round a whole bunch of Roman soldiers armed to the teeth? And then how could he walk to the town of Emmaus? We didn't read that today. It's in Luke's gospel. But then it records that he walked to the town of Emmaus and back again, which is 7 miles in each direction. Now, I don't know if you've ever stubbed your toe on the bed or something. I seem to do it fairly regularly these days. You stub your toe on the bed and it feels like your whole world has collapsed and you don't care about anything else anymore apart from your toe. And I then sort of hobble over to the bed and sit down and rub my toe for a while, okay? Can you imagine if you'd had nails put through your ankles? Can you imagine being able to do a 7-mile hike there and back? Doesn't sound very plausible to me. And then even then, could Jesus have been able to convince his disciples not just that he'd somehow survived, but that he'd actually conquered death? Because that's what they believed. They didn't believe that he'd somehow survived. They were convinced that this was an incredible miracle, that Jesus had beaten death itself. If Jesus had sort of crawled up to them in a sort of semi-comatose state, collapsed on the floor with bits of wooden nails sticking out of him, they're not going to be, that doesn't sound very, they're not going to think, yeah, he's beaten death. They're going to think, oh, okay. They're not going to at all be convinced that he's beaten death forever, are they? So if you want to believe that, you've got to believe that in spite of being close to death before being crucified, Jesus somehow survived crucifixion, survived a spear wound, got round an experienced team of Roman soldiers, 36 hours later with no food, no water, no medical care, manages to unwrap himself from all the bandages and stuff they put around him and the 35 kilos of spices, roll a massive stone away from the inside, overpower the soldiers, walk 7 miles to Emmaus and then back again, and then convince his followers that he's beaten death. I don't think that's very plausible. Number two. Let's say Jesus actually did die. Okay, let's say he did die, but let's say he didn't rise from the dead. Let's say he didn't rise from the dead. Let's say the disciples were overwhelmed with grief and they hallucinated it. Okay, let's say they all dreamed it. Because, you know, grief does do strange things to you, doesn't it? Grief does strange things to you. Basically, let's say they all suffered from some kind of mental illness, temporary or long-term. Is that plausible? Well, there are only certain kinds of people who are susceptible to hallucination. You might argue, if you know the Gospels well, you might argue that Mary Magdalene was susceptible, maybe. You know, she's obviously a very emotional kind of person, without being too stereotypical. But look at who else is there. You've got these hardened fishermen, James, John, Peter. They don't, to me, sound like the kind of guy. I mean, fishing is probably the most dangerous job in the world, the hardest job in the world, with the possible exception of mining. Okay, do they really sound like the kind of people who would be susceptible to emotional manipulation? You've got the mathematically minded tax collector, Levi, Matthew, who's wrote this gospel that we just read. You've got the cynical Thomas, who wouldn't accept, even when Jesus was standing in front of him, he said, I need to put my fingers in the nail prints. I need to put my hand into his side where that spear went in before I'll believe. You've got the convinced skeptic and enemy of Jesus, the Apostle Paul. And hallucinations are individual, aren't they? Like, they're linked to past experiences, into your subconscious. For even two people to agree on the same hallucination would be kind of weird, but for the whole group of maybe 30, 40, and at one time it says there were 500 people saw Jesus in one go, for all of them to have the same hallucination doesn't sound very plausible to me. And of course, hallucinations only work if you really, really want it to be true. Do you realize that? It only happens if you really want it to be true. Like, for example, if someone very close to you dies and you desperately, desperately want them to be alive again and you mull over it for long enough, maybe you can convince yourself that it's true. But these people in the Bible, they didn't think it was true at all. They were convinced he was dead. When the women arrive at the tomb, they say, who's going to roll the stone away for us? Because they expect him to be dead still. They don't expect him to be alive. When they report back to the men say, this is a great quote from Luke's gospel, the men did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. You know, when they came back and said, Jesus is alive, the tomb's empty, the guys go, yeah, right, really? Yeah, no, you're talking rubbish, women. They didn't believe it. When Peter goes to the tomb, he goes away, finds the tomb is empty, walks off, and it says he went away wondering to himself what had happened. It wasn't that he thought, oh yeah, Jesus must be alive. No, he thought, oh, that's weird. When Jesus appears to them all together, they're convinced that he's a ghost. They're not the kind of people that are susceptible to believing this. They were convinced that he was dead and gone and buried and forgotten. But the biggest of all, if they just dreamt it all, if they hallucinated it, then the Jewish authorities, or the Roman authorities, would have just produced the body. When they started going around saying, hey, Jesus is alive, Jesus is alive, they'd have just rolled the stone away, got his body out, and said, no, he isn't. Look. You see, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work. What about this one? Myth. Okay, so let's say Jesus died, but over time, this legend developed. Okay? Like King Arthur. All that stuff that Dan Brown writes about. Let's say, you know, this legend began to develop, and the stories grew, and they expanded with the retelling, until we get the fanciful gospel accounts. What if that's true? What if that's what happened? Does that make sense? Well, when you read the Gospels, honestly, it doesn't read like myth. It doesn't sound like mythology. It sounds like eyewitness accounts. You know, the details are very clear. The reactions of the people are just what you'd expect them to be. They say the sort of stupid things that sometimes people say. They do the sort of daft things that people sometimes do. And if you read some mythology, they're far more imaginative, far more weird and bizarre. It doesn't read like myth. Now, I said earlier that 150 years ago or so, this was the predominant view, actually, that the Gospels were written in the late second century, maybe 150 years after it all happened. But now we know that's not true. We know scholarship has improved immensely since 1850 or so. And we now know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were all written by AD 65, at the latest, really. And that's not long enough for a myth to develop. If you imagine something amazing happens today, let's say something spectacular, I don't know what, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. Let's just say something amazing happens today, all right? In 30 years' time, would it be plausible for people to say something completely different happened? It wouldn't, because all the people who are young enough to be around in 30 years' time would just say, you know what, that's rubbish. It wasn't like that, it was like this. That didn't happen, this happened. Okay, 30 years or so, which is how long the Gospels were written after it all happened, that's not long enough for myths to develop. Right, I'm going to have to move on a bit more quickly, aren't I? One more thing. So women feature very heavily in the story as well. Okay, now to us that's great, that's very PC, we like that sort of thing. Back in those days, if you wanted to convince someone that something was true, don't put women in the story, because women's testimony didn't count for anything. In those days, women were not allowed to testify in court. So to have women as being the first people to see the risen Jesus, that's nuts. If you're making it up, you wouldn't put that in. If you were making it up, you'd say it was Matthew was the first one there, because he was a tax collector, he was educated. Okay, you'd say him. You wouldn't have the two Marys and some other women who were unnamed, you wouldn't put them in if it was made up. If it was true, though, well, it's just honest, isn't it? It's an inconvenient truth, but it's honest. Okay, right. So although the idea of it all being a myth is popular with internet memes, no scholars believe that these days. No one believes that. Probably Richard Dawkins does. I think. Anyway, but nobody who knows what they're talking about when it comes to the New Testament. Number four, how about fraud? Okay, fraud. So how about the disciples drugged the guards, moved the stone away, unwrapped the body, buried it, and told everyone that Jesus had risen from the dead? Is that plausible? Is that plausible? The disciples stole the body. Does that work? Because that was what the Jewish leaders were afraid of. In fairness, That theory is probably the most plausible out of the ones I'm going to show you, because that's what the Jewish leaders were afraid of. That's why they went to Pilate and said, look, we're worried this might happen, because Jesus said he's going to rise again after 3 days. We think the disciples are going to steal the body and make a big thing of it. So they went to Pilate, and Pilate said, well, make the tomb as secure as you know how. Take some soldiers, make sure it doesn't happen. But let's say, even if, let's say they went for it anyway. Let's say they went for it. They decided we're going to steal the body. There's a few questions that spring to mind. Like, for example, if they had stole the body, if they drugged or attacked a bunch of Roman soldiers to be able to get the body, do you think the Romans would have taken that lying down? Do you think the Romans would have just let them get away with it? Or do you think the Romans would have killed every last one of them in about 24 hours, and that would have been the end of Christianity? Because that's the kind of thing the Romans did. They were pretty ruthless. You know, if they'd attacked the soldiers or tried to drug them, it would have been a suicide mission. Aside from that, though, let's remember the disciples were scared. They were terrified. Peter denied even knowing Jesus out of fear. And they all scattered. Where do they suddenly get all this confidence from? You know, come on, let's go and attack a bunch of Roman soldiers. Does that sound plausible to you? And what would be their motivation? You know, imagine if you'd been conned for 3 years. You'd given up everything. You'd given up your job, you'd given up your family to follow a cult leader who ends up dead. How are you going to feel? Are you going to think, yeah, I tell you what, let's make him into a hero? Or are you going to think, right, let's move on. Go back to the old job. Forget it ever happened. Wasted 3 years of my life, but fine. See, there's no motivation for them to get Jesus out of the tomb and pretend he's alive. Because if that's the case, they've all been conned for 3 years. And what's more, their Christian beliefs, their belief that Christ had risen from the dead, was a very good way of ending up dead yourself. There was a saying back in the first century, being a Christian is good, but short. And that's true, it was. 11 of the 12 disciples were martyred for their belief, were executed for their belief that Jesus rose from the dead, some of them very horribly. Some people are prepared to die for something they are convinced is true. But no one is willing to die for something that they know is a lie. If you knew that Jesus was dead and had not risen from the dead, despite what he said he'd do, you'd be devastated. The last thing you'd want to do is to make him into a hero, and the last thing you want to do is to die for that lie. Some of you will have heard of this guy, Charles Colson, Chuck Colson. He was implicated in the Watergate affair back in the 1960s. Great big political scandal in America, and this cover-up, and he went to jail for several months for what he did. He subsequently became a Christian, and he said this. He says, I know the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. How? Because 12 men testified they had seen Jesus risen from the dead, and they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. And every one of them was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison, which is true. They would not have endured that if it were not true. Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep the lie for 3 weeks. You're telling me 12 apostles could keep a lie for 40 years? Absolutely impossible. That really only leaves us with one explanation, unless you can think of any others. And there are a few more minority ones, like they were all just mad or something, or we're all mad, or, you know, this isn't real, none of this is real, we're living on a different planet. It's all kind of weird and wonderful. Really, sensible options, there's those four. Or, it's true. Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. He was buried, and he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. And if it's true, if that's true, It explains perfectly the skyrocketing confidence of the disciples. It explains perfectly the explosive growth of the early church. It explains why we're here today. If it's true, then it's a great hope. If it's true, it's a great hope. It's a great hope that there is life after death. It gives us great hope that death is not the end, that this life is not all there is, that Jesus has beaten our greatest enemy on our behalf, and through faith in him, we can too. That's a wonderful hope in a hurting world, that there is better to come in and through Jesus. If this stuff is true, it changes everything. It changes everything. If it's true, he is Lord and King and worthy of worship. But it's also a great warning. The Apostle Paul said this once. He was preaching. And he said this: God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He's given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. In other words, if Jesus is alive, that proves everything else he said was true as well. It proves that he's coming back. It proves that he's coming to judge the world. You can't remain neutral on this. You can't remain neutral on this. If Jesus is dead, Christians have nothing. If he did rise from the dead, it changes everything. It changes everything. I wonder this morning, what's your verdict? Where do you come down on these things? It really matters. It really matters. I wouldn't expect you to change your mind over the course of 20 minutes. If you're a hardened skeptic, like I said, it's great to have you here. I wouldn't expect you to change your mind in 20 minutes. But there's a great little book here that might help you just to think it through. To work it through. There's a lot more in here than I've been able to say this morning as well. So please do help yourself, and there'll be some around the place. I'm sure you can get one. Let's just have a moment of quiet, shall we? And then we'll sing our closing song together.